Hello and welcome to The Front Page. I'm Racing Post editor Tom Kerr. I'm your host today, and over the next half an hour we're going to be covering some of the biggest stories in racing from the last week and looking ahead to everything exciting happening over the coming days. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Front Page regular Maddie Playo. How are you doing, Maddie?
Yeah, very well, thank you, Tom.
Excellent. And over from Paris, our France correspondent Scott Burton. Bonjour, Scott.
Morning, Tom. Morning, Maddie. How's it all going?
Very good. Thank you very much. We're going to dive straight in, and I'm going to put forward the first story this week because I want to talk about something very important that is happening this week, which is that on Tuesday, tomorrow, the BHA board are going to meet to consider a range of proposals that could have a very profound impact on the future of British racing. Foremost among these proposals is what's known as premierisation. And this has been a controversial topic in the sport over recent weeks because it's a proposal that sets out a change to the racing calendar whereby on Saturdays, the majority of Saturdays over the year, there'll be a restricted period in the afternoon where only a handful of meetings can take place, with other meetings required to start and finish before 2 p.m. or start after 4 p.m. Now, the rationale behind this proposal is that it will spread fixtures over a wider period of the day, it will boost betting turnover and will allow bettors to more fully enjoy the action, particularly in this core afternoon period. However, it's very controversial because around 20 tracks, primarily the so-called small independents, but also some bigger tracks like Chester, are up in arms and saying it's going to cost them some of their most lucrative and popular fixtures and cost them hundreds of thousands of pounds per track. They're absolutely furious about the proposal, warning the devastating impact it will have on ticket sales, hospitality and sponsorship will negate the benefits gained from greater betting interest. And they've even threatened the prospect of legal action to stop the proposal. So this story is incredibly important for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is the sort of headline proposal on the table from this strategy work that's been ongoing over the last 12 months. And it's the first test, real test, of the new governing structure in British racing, whereby the BHA board has ultimate responsibility for making decisions, taking recommendations from the commercial committee, as it's called, which comprises a wide range of stakeholders in the sport, like racecourse groups, owners, trainers, jockeys, and the BHA itself. So it's a big topic, a complex one, but let's take the concept of premierisation, as it's known, as a policy first. What do we think, Maddie, of this idea that there should be fewer meetings in a core period on a Saturday? And I should say, it's not fewer fixtures overall.
Yeah.
It's just fewer fixtures in this core period.
Yeah, it's just funneling them away from this prime time, which on paper, I can understand it. You know, you want to be showing off racing's best product. And I think Julie Harrington used the word sort of this elite period. And often we get these Saturday afternoons that are just jam packed with action. No one knows where to look. And that's obviously going to have an impact on betting and just on general engagement, really, with the sport. The only issue is, like everything in British racing, there's so many different strands to this that someone's going to fall short, someone's going to be unhappy no matter what happens. Now, we've heard the boss at Thirsk, he was saying it will leave him with a £300,000 hole in his finances. So this is not just a little bit of sort of tweezing at tiny little things. This could have potentially huge ramifications. And I say that, but equally, one of the curious things about this is that we don't actually know that much about it. Mm. We don't know fundamentally how much we stand to gain. We know a little bit about how much we stand to lose some of those smaller independent tracks. You know, could some of them be forced out of business because of this? I want to see more of the working out behind the committee's proposals. Hopefully that will come in this following week. But ultimately, it's the people behind this decision and the new strategy, it's still facing the same problems, ultimately, in that you've got different people pulling in different directions I think it's commendable what they're trying to do, and I understand it. But at the same time, I struggle to see how we're all going to work in the same direction with, you know, if people are threatening legal action and saying, okay, we'll go on a trial period of you can take control of our fixtures for 2 years, but we want to be financially compensated for that. It's all just awfully messy. And that's
happened almost immediately. And you know, we at the Racing Post have covered for years how dysfunctional racing's system of running the sport is.
Yeah.
Previously, it basically had, ludicrously, a situation where any interest group could veto a decision they didn't like. Mm. And so, for example, a proposal like this, which the independents didn't like, veto.
Yeah.
Now, we have a different system, and at its first test, the people who previously would have wielded the veto are now saying, well, we'll take it to court. I mean, whether or not this goes ahead and whether or not it ends up in the court, it basically, the new structure is facing a enormous test at the very first hurdle. And if what we get is a messy compromise, which doesn't really satisfy anyone, but it's the only thing we can get through, then we're basically back where we started.
Yeah, I'm personally of the view that when we look at British racing and we look at where it stands in the global standing, I mean, even just last week we saw about how well Irish racing is doing with that Deloitte survey, for instance, and
employment up,
and it's absolutely booming, and we know obviously the Irish are dominating and have a very healthy industry at the moment, but I think we really need some action in British racing. You know, this is all surrounding the 2024 fixture list, which is still some way off. Mm. We need to do something. I think it's really getting to the point now where, you know, we're getting small fields, uncompetitive racing, poor prize money. We can't just afford to sit back and let it happen anymore. And we've been saying that for a long time. So I would rather see action and, you know, short-term pain for long-term gain. That's how I think British racing should be seeing this. But of course, you can only really do that if all participants see the bigger picture. And if it's not in their personal business interest to see that bigger picture, then of course they're not going to.
Absolutely. And Scott, I'm sure looking on from France, you are once again shaking your head at the dysfunction of Les Rosbifs. What do we think about the policy? Let's take the impact on small tracks. Now, clearly, if small tracks are losing lucrative fixtures, it's not just about the economic impact to them, it's also about the ability for people in different parts of the country to go racing at a time which is optimal. I guess on the flip side, having more evening meetings might actually be a good opportunity for the sport.
I think one of the things that strikes me is that whenever even the most minor tweaks have been attempted at this in the past, the various interest groups you talk about, specifically within some of the larger as well as the smaller racecourse ownership groups, have always said, well, we're not completely against it, but show us the evidence. And I think what's been different about this process is that there is a lot more evidence, although rather opaquely, we can't see it. The bookmakers have contributed large amounts of data and modelling from how they think these changes to the way that Saturdays are structured, the way that Sundays are structured. As you say, we might be looking at Sunday evening racing, which has thus far been the third rail in terms of scheduling racing in Britain. There is a lot more data that's been contributed. It's been given to one of the leading consultancy firms in London so that confidentiality is preserved between the different operators. Obviously, Entain don't want Skybet and Paddy Power looking in their books any more than the other way around. So the actual data is there to actually make an informed decision. From that point of view, there seems to be a consensus, certainly amongst the bigger racecourse groups, from the BHA number crunches, that this will actually have a positive impact. I know that the chief executive of Chester came out the other day and said she felt she hadn't seen enough data. I think the data is there to justify it on a strategic level, but clearly if you are running Thirsk or Chester is a very, very successful racecourse that has a lot of Saturday fixtures, and you're being told you've got to run at 12 at lunchtime and be finished by 2, or alternatively, you can't start till 4:30 in the afternoon. That's a massive impact on your business model. I think the question is not whether they're going to run straight to the law courts, but whether what James Sanderson came out and said last week is a kind of bargaining chip, and potentially the Racecourse Association have been trying to put out a few fires over the weekend, and maybe there'll be a better financial settlement for the losers in inverted commas in this process. That then by the time it's all announced on Thursday, they can be a bit more on board with it. But as I say, I think, although we have to take it on trust, I think the data is there from, speaking
but,
to...
But Scott, I think the thing about the data is, as you rightly say, we haven't seen the data, but what we can pretty clearly guess the data shows is that by extending the racing day over a wider period, starting earlier, finishing later, you are going to increase betting turnover on those races to the net benefit of the sport in terms of media rights and levy. However, for those race courses who are losing fixtures in the middle of the day, they're assuming there's going to be a significant decline in their attendance income, their hospitality income, and their sponsorship income. And their point basically is that, well, unless they're compensated significantly, which is basically a subsidy, then they're going to be net losers. Now, this is the fundamental problem with racing. Basically, the sport will not allow anything to happen if any one part of the sport is a net loser. But that massively restricts the sport's ability to implement significant change and to move forward, unless, of course, as we discuss here, they basically pay off the losers, which seems to be slightly self-defeating.
Well, yeah, if you're basically trying to come up with a system that generates a larger pie overall, more betting revenue, better exposure for the big races on a Saturday afternoon, which is potentially good for sponsors, all the things that would actually grow the size of the financial pie in the sport, and therefore potentially that would be a good thing for the participants. The other side of the equation, if you like, the other member of the old tripartite system, the trainers and the owners, who want better prize money, they want incentives to not sell their horses to Hong Kong and Australia, but to actually keep them in training in Britain. All of those things that can be achieved with premierisation and various other levers they might wish to pull, obviously that's negated if you've then got to pay a huge chunk of money to the smaller race courses because they're losing footfall through the door. I don't think you can blame the chief executive of, we're going to say Thirst, because James Sanderson is the one who came out and spoke. I don't think you can blame him for not considering that his prime motivation is whether horses racing 90 to 105 get sold to Hong Kong or get to stay in Britain, because there's none of them running at his track in the first place. Mm. So I understand his point of view. I think the key question is this a bargaining position to be given some money, or do they actually seriously want to go to court? There are, ever going back to 2004 and the deal that the old British Horse Racing Board, the predecessor of the BHA, did to avoid being sued by the Office of Fair Trading, there has always been this grey area in British racing about who actually owns the fixtures. There are probably several racecourse executives in Britain who would like to be able to say, we don't actually care. We're just going to put on race fixtures. All that we care is Weatherby's process the entries. We'll put on the prize money. We'll race whenever we feel like it, and that's that. Obviously, there is some structure at the moment. The British Horse Racing Authority produces a fixture list every year, come August, September time. It still has some control over it, but 85% of those fixtures are actually owned by the racecourses, and a prospective court battle would then put that back in play, and there'd be people who say, we want a more centralized system, maybe we would get a better result out of that. But this would completely grind the current proposals to a halt, and you wouldn't be looking at any changes to the 2024 fixture list. So it could end up getting very messy before there's some clarity to come out of it.
It could indeed, Scott. It would be very racing for this to end up in a prolonged legal dispute where the only winners were our learned friends. We'll wrap up that conversation there, but we will absolutely be returning to this both on this show and on the Racing Post website app and in the newspaper. We expect while the board meeting takes place Tuesday, tomorrow, we do not expect to necessarily hear a great deal on the day. We may get news of a decision. However, I'm told it's more likely that we will not find out exactly what's been agreed, and there will be other proposals on the table as well until Thursday, or potentially the following week if the board meeting does not conclude with a decision and it overspills into the following week's session. But whatever the decision is, you will hear of it first and get the best analysis with the Racing Post. Before we move to our second story, a very quick break for a advert for Members Club Ultimate, our premium subscription service on which you will find a lot of that in-depth analysis and exclusive news around topics like premierization, as well as a ton of other stuff. Welcome back. We are now going to go to Maddie for our second story. Take it away, Maddie.
Yeah, slightly worrying story this, and a sad one. We learned a few weeks ago that the trainer, Robin Brisland, who won the Brocklesby, you'll remember at the start of the season, and his assistant or a high up member of his staff, William Deignan, they were fined £8,000in the case involving abuse against their staff. You know, that it was verbal tirades, there were treatment that resulted in staff sustaining injuries, and just a very unsavoury, unsafe workplace that we learned of. And the news this week was that on Wednesday, Brisland is now being, he's appointing a safeguarding champion within his yard. In order to oversee the atmosphere and the changes. We don't know exactly when the visits are going to take place to sort of review his yard. But yeah, this is just the latest step in this story, which I think ultimately is, you know, reflects very poorly on racing. And it's just incredibly sad because the thing is with these training yards is they're often in very isolated areas. You know, in racing particularly, we employ quite a young workforce. And, you know, this is a case where people have clearly been exploited in the workplace, which is just horrible, really. And there was lots of contention over the fine and whether that was just at the time. And but now I guess
Do we think that was an appropriate fine? And an appropriate way to handle the case, because you know, I think the other thing that we have to bear in mind here is the complete lack of detail that has been forthcoming from either the judicial panel or the BHA about exactly what happened. And indeed, we had a reporter in the hearing, and they detailed some of what had happened there. Mm. But had we not had a reporter there, there has been no official detail whatsoever about this case and the particulars of it.
Yeah, I think that's the hugely worrying thing, is that there was the potential for this to sort of just be swept under the carpet and forgotten about. Look, an £8,000 fine, it doesn't sound a lot of money in some ways, considering the severity of the behaviours and the actions that took place. Whether you put into that suspensions so that, you know, you take away the trainer's right to earn a living and employ people during this time, or whatever else. But as we spoke about earlier, Tom, you can see the potential issues with someone, with the trainer, who was already, you know, full foul on sort of the standards we accept in British racing, having to appoint someone from within his own yard. Now, we know that there was an incredibly toxic culture there, So is that the best way to see a good conclusion to this and see that those standards return to the levels that they should be at? I'll leave you guys to make up your own minds.
It does feel a little bit unsatisfactory. One of the things that I thought was astonishing about that BHA statement announcing the appointment on a safeguarding individual in the yard was that it said the details of the case are now a matter of public record through the panel's written reasons, which were announced simultaneously.
Yeah.
The written reasons are three paragraphs long.
Yeah. And there was not a lot, as you've said, there was not a lot of detail in
there.
There's
no detail.
So how on earth is that?
We do not feel as a panel it is appropriate for us to make any further observations regarding the proposed evidence. What is going on? I'm astonished by it. Sure, you know, again, if we didn't have a reporter there, none of this would have come out. What sort of messes is this sending to prospective people looking to get into the industry? Now, we know that most yards are not like that. However, I think anecdotally, everyone who works in racing has heard some horror stories. And since this story, I've heard some more. And we all have a responsibility, whether journalists, trainers, professionals, regulator, disciplinary panel, to do everything possible to ensure that where that sort of behaviour exists, it's rooted out and exposed. I do not think that can be said to have happened in this case.
No. Well, ultimately, that lack of detail, as you say, gives you absolutely zero confidence in the regulatory structures that are in place. And the fact that this is the action and this is where we see ourselves in this case is just really, really sad, I think, and ultimately not good enough.
No. Scott, anything similar to this has happened in France?
I can't think of anything obvious. You occasionally get the stewards taking action if they see somebody an abuse situation on the race course. You might get a trainer who shouts at a member of staff. They'll occasionally get taken in and a chat with the stewards and maybe a fine. But
if that happens on a race course where everyone's able to see it, it just begs the question: what happens in this case when you're in pockets of the countryside and there's no one there to report it, doesn't it?
Well, indeed, yes. Yeah.
I think that the thing there's two things that kind of astonished me about last week's, I would say, developments in the case, but it barely moved the thing forward at all, did it? We'd all been waiting for almost a month for these written reasons, and you say three paragraphs, which we're told is a courtesy from the panel to the wider sporting public, but frankly, three paragraphs is a bit of an insult. The key phrase where they talked about considering that the £8,000 fine and the £3,000 fine, respectively, to the two individuals, reflect the available evidence. They said that this was something that reflects the available evidence. Well, as far as we can work out from our colleague who was waiting for the hearing to start, and then obviously the hearing didn't start, they potentially the lawyers and the three members of the panel spent less than 2 hours discussing this. The amount of evidence that would have been presented in a case that they'd set aside 4 days for, obviously they had a number of witnesses, including people who had been suffered at the hands of these two individuals. I think it's fair to say that they have not really sifted all the available evidence. And so from that point of view, can you say that £8,000 is a sufficient fine, a sufficient deterrent, a sufficient encouragement for people in a similar situation, as you say, however small a minority of yards this may happen, potentially much younger people who are in a situation where it takes quite a lot of courage to come forward and speak about an abusive employer, an older abusive employer who basically has your career in their hands. There's no encouragement for anybody to come forward in that because they think, well, it's not going to be seriously treated. And it's not really a very rigorous examination of that available evidence if you're going to come to a plea within the space of, say, of less than 2 hours for a case that was supposed to take 4 days.
Matty, last word on this. The stable staff sort of union, the representative body for that, what's been their approach to this and what do we think needs to change in the future?
Yeah, I think it's a very tricky situation, isn't it? Because, as I say, you've got individual employers in various spots of the countryside responsible for their teams. And as Scott said, it's that hierarchical power dynamic between trainer and employer. And I think what NAS and other organisations need to be doing is thinking about ways where stable staff feel safe enough and feel like they can come forward and talk about their experiences, because we know it happens, but the journey that has to go on to actually result in inquiries, in fines, in suspensions, whatever you have it, like this, rarely meets its conclusion. So I think ultimately we need to be thinking about how we can make the dynamics better and healthier in racing yards, so that if there are issues, stable staff are empowered to speak up about it. Because I think that's kind of what we see in the weighing room, for instance, with this omerta of silence on certain issues. And it seems like that sort of attitude seeped into racing yards as well. It's an incredibly difficult situation for in this instance, those stable staff members to have been in. And, you know, the bravery of people speaking out about their experiences is ultimately, you know, one of the main things that can provide a catalyst to changing attitudes and stamping it out. So, I commend them for taking action.
Yeah, well said, and a really important story, Maddie. We're going to finish by heading over to our France correspondent. We're going to look at the classic picture again. Thankfully, the last week cleared everything up, didn't it, Scott?
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah. I know, obviously, in terms of the Derby, we came out of Chester and a whole host of trials thinking we're really desperate for clarity. It's all been run on very soft ground, very messy racing and all the rest of it. York will clear it all up for us. It's the fairest racetrack in the country, good ground, really good field for the Dante. Everything will be sold. And of course, we ended up with four horses all running some kind of a very good race. The Foxes winning the Dante Stakes, chased home by White Birch from an unfashionable Irish yard. And then with Passenger getting no luck, really, you know, three times probably could have, if things had gone differently, got a run, potentially would have been very close there at the line. And an Aidan O'Brien horse, Continuous, who was the only one of the principals who hadn't had a run before, who ran pretty well and showed he handled good ground as well, having won here on soft ground in the very infamous race where Christophe Soumillon elbowed Ross O'Ryan off. And he actually remembers who won that race, but Continuous was the winner of that race. And we're actually in a situation where if you were to even run the Dante again, let alone the Derby, you could ask four people and they'd give you four different answers as to who might win just between those four. So it is a wide open Derby picture. That probably doesn't please everybody, but those of us whose memories go back a long way, it's like an old-fashioned Derby, really. It's a kind of 4-1 the field type of thing. I did a little bit of research. I looked back through the last 8 or 9 years, and this is the, just statistically speaking, Military Order 7-2 and Auguste Rodin 9-2. That is the most open Derby picture in the last 8 or so years. You know, we've had really hot favourites at this point, 2 weeks out. Saxon Warrior was odds on. I think Desert Crown was 2-1 last year. So normally we have a pretty good idea which horse is going to go off favourite for the Derby by this stage. There's obviously quite a lot of headwinds against the race this year. We'll probably come on to talk about our friends at Animal Rising at some stage, but obviously it's Cup final day as well. It's a very early start. There's lots of reasons to be a little bit despondent, but it is the Derby. And I think, as I think Brough Scott said on ITV Racing last week, you could take 15 horses in the race. They've all got some sort of chance. You can't sell that kind of Derby. What can you sell?
Yeah, I agree, Scott. It's absolutely fantastic, actually, to see such a open race. Maddie, did you feel that the Dante meeting shed a great deal of light on how we expect the Colts Classic to unfold?
No,
There we go. Okay.
No. And it's even more puzzling by the confidence behind Auguste Rodin, who we haven't seen since the Guineas when he was bitterly disappointing. Eh? No, Brian keeps coming out saying, no, he's our number one. So as much as Scott was sort of playing the case of continuous there, who I thought ran a good race, the extraordinary thing is, to me, you've got a horse who's second favourite and, you know, was joint favourite, who on his only start this season had been comprehensively beaten in a classic. He's going to face totally different conditions at Epsom. I don't think he should be anywhere near the price he is, to be honest with you. But saying that, it's a very open picture and he is a Group 1 winner. And we know he's an incredibly talented horse and on pedigree he should stay the trip. So it's just a puzzle, isn't it, really? My main takeaway from the Dante meeting was probably that run of Passenger, just because I think he is the most talented of the three-year-old colts we've seen in Britain so far this year. And that's saying something, considering he's a Wooditton winner and that was just his second ever start. Whether he'll stay in the mile and a half trip of the Derby, being by Ulysses, who did stay that far but didn't necessarily want that far, and he's at such formative stages of his career, and given he's trained by Sir Michael Stout, who doesn't tend to rush his horses, and considering they've got to stump up 85 grand to supplement him, he is the big talking horse, the big what-if horse for me. I'm really excited to see how it's going to play out with him.
And spending that 85 grand to supplement would be what's known in the trade as a clue.
Yeah, exactly. But I think you're dealing with connections, you know, the Niarchos family, Sir Michael Stout, they like to keep their cards very close to their chest. Mm. So they're going to be in a place where they're probably not going to want to give anything away until the last minute. But we'll find out when that supplementary deadline arrives. So they clearly thought a lot enough of him to supplement him for the Dante. And that was a race that Sir Michael Stout has obviously took with some of his Derby winners. So you've got to sort of do that in racing, haven't you? Follow the pattern of behaviour of trainers. So we'll see if he goes through and has another contender after Desert Crown last year. He's got a really strong stable. I think that's one of the themes of the season so far for me, Sir Michael Stout. You know, not that he ever went away, but he's really enjoying this renaissance now. And hopefully we will see last year's Derby winner very soon.
It's going to be a fascinating couple of days on the Downs next month, but as you alluded to, Scott, storm clouds are very much present over the race. We have seen a few stories in recent days about Animal Rising's plans to disrupt the race, including in today's Racing Post, and we obviously saw them in action at the Grand National meeting, Scottish Grand National, and weirdly at Doncaster one night. Now they make no secret whatsoever that they intend to disrupt the Derby. It's all over their website. They're looking for people to sign up. They're boasting about hundreds, even thousands of individuals disrupting the race. And as we know, Scott, Epsom is a very challenging course to secure. Just how big a threat to the race is this proposed action?
I think it is something everybody has to take very seriously. I think the choreography of the day this year, because the race is being run so early, because the FA Cup final very unusually is on the first weekend of June, actually makes their threat more of something to take seriously. Because of course there's a moment at which ITV will have to either go off air or shunt over to ITV4. They know that they actually only have to delay the race by 20-25 minutes, and at that point, then the vast majority of the audience is off to go and watch the cup final. So a little bit similar to with the Grand National, there was actually only in the end a 20-minute delay, but that actually caused quite a lot of havoc for ITV, and there would have been quite a lot of pressure to actually get that race started, you know, get the protesters moved and get that race started on time. I think that pressure will return to Epsom. As you allude to, it's a very, very difficult site to quote unquote defend. It's public land. There's an act of parliament, which means that anybody can go on the downs to walk their dog or watch the racing or stage a peaceful protest. And that act of parliament had to be suspended for one day during COVID, when we had a behind closed doors Oaks and Derby on the same day. There's no chance that that's going to be reenacted for this, nor should it be, really. Everybody has, in some sense, a a right to peaceful protest, although not necessarily to totally disrupt the running of the derby or any other sporting event. It is a very, very difficult site to defend. As I say, it's maybe not quite as large a perimeter as Aintree, but it's not private land. And as I say, with that kind of hard deadline of ITV going off to cover the football, I could see it being a very, very fraught afternoon for Epsom executives, for the Metropolitan Police, and also for ITV as well.
I suspect you're right. I anticipate that 1:30 start time might not be solely down to the football start time, and there may just be a little bit of leeway built into that broadcast for exactly the reasons you say, Scott. Let's assume, and I think it's pretty short odds, I'm afraid to say, that there will be some form of disruption at Epsom, and that some Animal Rising protesters get on the track and they once again are given a very prominent platform to put forward their message, which is that animals should not be used for any sort of human use. That means they shouldn't be eaten, they shouldn't be used for entertainment, they shouldn't be used for sport. If that happens, Scott, how should racing respond?
Well, how long have you got? I think there are two things here. I think, obviously, we need to continue to absolutely trumpet how well horses are looked after and how really desperately keen we are to continue to improve safety. We've seen, actually not in Britain, but in other jurisdictions, a number of awful events. You look at the Kentucky Derby the other week, where there were seven horses killed at Churchill Downs in the week of the Derby, including two on the undercard on the day of the race itself. And the favourite was taken out by the state vets. Obviously, the BHA have just introduced a new system of on the day veterinary checks for certain high profile meetings. They started at Newbury on Saturday for the Lock Inch, trotting up horses, comparing the way they walk, the way they trot with previous video that's been taken of a particular horse. What you don't want is a horse that's got slightly strange action to be taken out by a vet, even though it's actually moving in completely the same way it does normally. I think things like that and actually making a big public statement about that are vitally important. As Lee Motta said, has argued in the paper on a number of occasions, we're not going to change the minds of people who believe in just eradicating the use of animals for human pleasure at all. They are entitled to their opinion. It is a very radical opinion, which obviously finds little favour in the racing community. But it's the kind of the middle broad consensus that you have to try and convince. And I think so, demonstrating that you are really putting safety of horses and therefore human participants at the centre of these things is vitally important. The other thing I think that makes racing a bit of a hostage to these things now that Animal Rising is targeting it, is because of the changes in legislation in terms of public order, the right to protest and all the rest of it, the police now can do quite a lot of things, and even private security firms can do quite a lot of things in advance of a protest. And if somebody gets marched off, as happened before the Grand National at, I think it was Manchester Railway Station, wasn't even in Liverpool, on suspicion of doing something, that's one thing. I think the way that these protests are policed in front of the television cameras, in front of 60,000 people on Epsom, is also quite crucial. And I think, you know, wherever your sympathies lie in terms of people's right to protest, the scenes of the police or security, private security, relishing removing protesters from that is just not a good look, is it? It's not something that racing wants to be associated with, and not a lot we can do about it. It's just, you know, if they're going to wear pink T-shirts again or whatever the tactic will be this time, as I say, the sight of bobbies in helmets running in there with batons and you know, wrestling people to the floor and handcuffing them behind there, it's not a great look. So, and that's nothing racing could do anything about. All we can do is be on the front foot about how seriously we take welfare. And also, if there are, and this goes back to Maddie's story about treatment of humans, but if there are stories that come to light about the very, very rare occasions where standards of care of horses come to light, we have to absolutely expose those as well. There's no point in trying to hide those and say, well, that's 1% and 99% of horses are treated very, very well. We have to come down hard on those as well. We can't put those away. We have to be clear and open about what our sport is.
Absolutely, Scott. Well said. I think sometimes there is a school of thought within racing that suggests that stories which do not reflect well on the sport should be suppressed or covered with kid gloves. I simply think that if the racing does that, then others will gleefully point out our flaws, and it's beholden on us as a sport and as an industry to be continuously improving. We're going to have to wrap the show up there, but it's been a fantastic debate. Many thanks to Maddie and to Scott for your contributions. I'm contractually required to pick a story for the front page, and I'm afraid I'm going to go with mine, premierisation. The classic, obviously a huge story, Brisland, enormously important, but I think this week we're going to find out what the outcome is of sort of 12 months of strategy work, or the initial outcome, and its impact on the future of racing could be truly profound. So that one is going to go on the front page this week. That's a wrap from us this week. I really appreciate you joining us. I hope you have a fantastic week, and I hope you join us again next Monday for more racing debate. In the meantime, I'm going to leave you with an advert for our Racing Post app. Thanks again.